Good morning. This is the Senior Citizens Advisory Council meeting on senior engagement. And today is August 15th. I'd like to call the meeting to order. First, may we have the Pledge of Allegiance, Elizabeth?
Yes, so if everyone will please stand and we get the flag. Okay, begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag.
Of the United States of America,
and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty
and justice for all.
Thank you.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Elizabeth. And would you continue with a roll call?
Yes. All right. Tony Alvarado.
I'm here.
Elizabeth Busick here, Carol Downey
here,
Scott Fegg, Elaine Genoway, Sherry Horn
here,
Carolyn Inman, Jim Levy, John Pointer
here,
Tony Rodella. Tony, where are you?
He's down there.
Yeah,
he's muted. He's muted.
Hoorah!
Okay.
Dave Tetzloff.
Here.
Evelyn Velez.
Here.
Paulo Morales. All right.
Okay.
We have a quorum.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And Paulo isn't here, so we don't have a new member to introduce yet. So let's go right on to our special presentation. This is over here in my corner, Deputy District Attorney, Bethel Cope Vega. She's been with Orange County's DA's office for over 6 years. She is currently the Child Abuse and Elder Abuse Prosecutor for the county and is passionate about fighting for justice in both child and elder abuse cases. Prior to handling these cases, she prosecuted sexual assault cases in the juvenile courts and most recently prosecuted domestic violence cases. Her experience teaching public school in the city of Compton, California, inspired her to become a DDA in order to continue having a positive impact on our local communities. I want to thank you so much. Do I call you DDA?
Oh, no. Please call me Bethel.
Okay. I want to thank you so much, Bethel, for being with us. As I mentioned on the phone, we are relatively new to this assignment on elder abuse, and we're really trying to gather as much information as possible about the needs out there. So thank you. And are you going to have a presentation?
I think I am. We're going to give it a good college try. I did want to just say thank you all for inviting me. I love my job so much, and I am always excited and grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. So we'll get right into it. I'm going to attempt to screen share a PowerPoint. It's mostly to keep me on track. So let's see what we can do.
While you do that, let me ask people to please mute.
It looks like participant screen sharing is disabled, so I may not be able to do that. And if not, that's fine. We can go without it.
Just give Desiree a moment.
Desiree is working on it.
There we go.
Okay, here we go. Does that look like you are looking at a PowerPoint slide now? Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, so there's my contact information, and I always invite people, that is my work cell phone number. Feel free to call it. Feel free to use it if you ever have questions. I'm often in court, but I really do love engaging with the community. And I always say that prosecuting these sorts of cases is a team sport. It really takes, you know, all of us sort of working together in order to be successful at it. So we'll go ahead and start with just an overview, and I don't mean to make this too basic, so if I'm covering things that you are already experts in, by all means, I will move along. But I wanted to give a brief overview of what we mean when we're talking about elder abuse law. So there are a couple of different types of elder abuse law. I handle the sort of the physical, all of the felony elder abuse cases in Orange County are my cases. And the penal code that we typically operate under the most often is Penal Code 368, subsection B1. And that's the penal code that governs essentially anybody who is over the age of 65, which can be feels like a real arbitrary cutoff sometimes. I'll see cases every once in a while where the individual is 64 and a half, and we cannot charge any crimes under this particular penal code. It doesn't mean that we can't charge any crimes. It just means that we can't necessarily go for this specific penal code. This penal code requires, aside from someone being over the age of 65, it requires that the person being charged willfully inflict either unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering, or that the person being charged permits somebody over the age of 65 to suffer unjustifiable physical pain or mental suffering, or while having the care or custody of somebody over the age of 65, they willfully caused or permitted their person or health to be injured. And then the other thing that this particular code section requires is that the person being charged did, under circumstances or conditions likely to produce great bodily harm or injury, did inflict that suffering or cause that suffering. And then finally, the age of 65 or over. So that gives us a little bit of room. It doesn't always require physical injury. As far as, I'm sorry, the last thing that it always requires is that the person being charged knows or reasonably should know that the victim in these cases is over the age of 65. And the way that that applies for us when we charge cases is we're really looking for some sort of relationship between the person we're charging and the victim. So usually it's going to be a caretaker or a family member. In my cases where there's pretty extensive physical abuse and injury, it's almost always the grown child of the victim who is the defendant in our cases. And there's almost always, as you can probably imagine, mental health issues involved. We do sometimes get caretaker cases. There's a sort of a line, and it's always sort of a moving target between felony and misdemeanor. But when we're charging felony elder abuse, we're looking for pretty severe injury. Since the penal code references great bodily injury, typically what that means is broken bones, extensive stitches, sometimes a trip to the emergency room with surgery. That's typically what the law accepts as being great bodily injury. I have on occasion charged a non-injury because of the mental suffering as a felony. And in that, I have one or two of those cases where the poor victims, in one of the cases is actually a married couple, a mom and dad, and it was their son. And for the past 2 years, he had essentially been terrorizing, and they both used that word, terrorizing them. And they would seek protective orders, and he would constantly, you know, barge in and come over. And there was some physical violence without extensive injury, but it was, I think, more of them living in fear. When is he going to come next? What's going to happen? When is he going to get angry and go off? They were looking for ways to move out of their home, hide from him, essentially. It was really a heartbreaking situation. So in that case, I did charge a felony, even though we didn't have extensive injury. And then there's also financial abuse, which is another extensive area of law. And actually, I don't handle the financial abuse cases. That's handled by one of our DDAs in our frauds unit. Her name is Tina Patel, and she's very good at her job. And so, you know, she handles a lot of the cases where the caretaker or the child or even some sort of health provider is taking advantage and, you know, taking money out of accounts unknownst to the victim. It's not physical in any way. Those are usually felonies depending on the dollar amount, but there's some sort of usually financial fraud involved. So something else I thought might be helpful to you all in this presentation is sort of just explaining what goes into filing a case in general, because I think even before I began this particular job, I really didn't have any idea what, you know, what sort of elements were involved in a decision like that. So essentially, you know, when a crime happens, it's reported directly to the police, and the police will go out and do their investigation and write their reports, and then they'll submit it to my office for filing. So when it comes in as a felony elder abuse with injury, all of those cases go to me for review. If there's an arrest involved, if they arrest somebody on the scene, then we have 48 hours to make a filing decision. And if there's no arrest, then we have a little bit more time. So I think what makes evaluating these cases a challenge is that we're looking for corroboration. And it's not just in these cases. I think in any case that my office charges, we really need some level of corroboration. So we need witnesses. We need some sort of physical evidence. We don't need all of these things, but we need a little bit of at least one of these things. So if there's physical evidence, if there's an injury, if there are statements from, you know, more than one person at the scene and they match each other, they're not conflicting statements, then we have more than just the victim's statements. And the reason why we need that is because lots of times, as you can imagine, with abuse that happens inside the home, they end up being one-on-one situations. So when somebody gets the courage to call the police and they're scared and they want help in that moment, they tell their story to the police. And then when the police go and interview the defendant, of course the defendant denies it. And now we have only two statements and they conflict. And that typically isn't sufficient, which can be unfortunate. It certainly doesn't mean that we don't believe the victim, but there's a very good reason for needing the corroboration. And so that sort of takes us into what can be challenging about these cases. So because they're one-on-one and because they usually take place in the home, and there's typically that family relationship. I mean, the parent and the child relationships is the most heartbreaking dynamic. You know, as a parent myself, it breaks my heart. But often what we see is after the initial report and the suspect, the person's child, they get arrested and taken away. Then once the victim is safe, they begin to, you know, second guess themselves and have second thoughts. And usually, and I would say this happens in probably 75% of our cases, we get a victim who changes their mind about wanting prosecution and begins to sort of backtrack and recant their statements and say, actually, that's not what happened. And I lied because I was scared. And they begin to tell a different story. And this is really common in all sorts of cases that involve families. We see it in domestic violence between partners and spouses as well. It's, in fact, the rates of it happening in those cases are even higher. You know, 90% probably of those cases, we get what we call a recanting victim. And so when by the time this case can get to trial, and these cases take a while, it could be a year and a half before we're at trial, and we bring in our victim, and our victim looks at the jury now a year and a half later, and all they want is their child to be, you know, home and out, and they really do believe things will get better once, you know, once they're past this particular incident, then they come into trial and say, nope, that's not what happened at all. That he never touched me. He did not hit me. I fell. Or, you know, I fell off the bed. I ran into the door. I accidentally, you know, hurt myself in the bathroom. So they begin to tell a very different story. And when we don't have any other corroboration, it's impossible to continue forward with a case like that when our victim changes their mind about their story. And so that's one of the things that makes it really difficult to prosecute these cases. We're always looking for corroboration. So maybe we have a neighbor. A lot of my cases like this, there's a neighbor who hears, you know, the shouting and the yelling. And Frank, you know, most of the time the neighbors heard it multiple times. Well, every time her son comes over, you know, we hear the yelling. And this time I heard her yelling, please help me. And maybe the neighbor even saw him chase her down the street. I've got that in a couple of my cases. So there's a level of corroboration that that the defendant was being the aggressor there. And so even if mom comes in and takes the witness stand a year and a half later and says, no, I hurt myself, nothing happened. Then the neighbor can come in and say, well, actually, here's what I saw. And so there's the corroboration piece and why it's so important. But as you can imagine, a lot of times our victims don't want to participate. It's a really difficult thing to be a victim in the criminal justice system. I tell that to all my victims. You know, you're sort of the person in the courtroom with the least amount of rights, unfortunately. And it's truly unfortunate. But it's you know, you're at the whim of the defense and how long they want the sort of pretrial period to be drawn out. And to see your child or your caretaker either in court when you don't want to see them or see them in custody is very difficult. So it makes a lot of sense why victims don't want to participate. And there are lots of times when I have to charge a case anyways, even though they don't want me to, I need to for their own safety. So as we talked about, in most of my cases, the felony injury, the defendant is most often their own child. And so, you know, asking somebody to come in and testify against their child is a really big ask. It's a very difficult thing to do. And we do it because lots of times that child is mentally ill or dangerous. And we want to make sure that our victim is safe and that everybody else in society is safe. Public safety is our number one concern most of the time in these cases. So victims, as I said, they recant their statements, they change their statements. And if we don't have the corroboration, it's impossible for us to move forward. And then of course we have the physical limitations to bringing in victims. Some of them are housebound or wheelchair bound, and it's very difficult to ask them to come in and sit in court for half a day. Or they're extremely old. Some of my victims are in their 90s and, you know, there's a concern for their health and a concern for how long they're going to be with us. And so we have to sort of take some extra steps sometimes of getting conditional exams done and getting statements of theirs recorded early on in the process to preserve the case. So one of the things I was asked to talk about is how we can improve the process for prosecuting these cases. And this is where I think our discussion really begins. So one of the things that I think can thwart us sometimes is having our cases reported through the proper channels. I can't tell you how many times I get letters, and my investigator, we get letters. Sometimes they're addressed to our elected DA, Todd Spitzer, but we get anonymous letters written about potential elder abuse. And I mean, don't get me wrong, we always appreciate the Good Samaritan who is trying to protect a neighbor or a friend, but my office is not an investigating agency. And when we get anonymous letters, that's really difficult because we can't use an anonymous letter in court. You know, it's hearsay. So we need an actual victim or a witness with a name and an identity that we can ask to come in and talk about what they've seen. And so when we get these letters, we have to send them back out to the police agencies. And I don't know if they get lost in the shuffle, but I do think that perhaps some sort of awareness or education around making that call to the police. I think that people are hesitant to call the police. You know, there's a sometimes a distrust. People don't want to get the police involved, but that's really where these cases all start. And the police, in my experience, are more than happy to come and take a report and then submit it to our office. But that's really the only way that we can get these cases rolling, is to make sure that they are, that they start and generate with the police agency. The other thing that I wish we had a little bit of a better handle on a relationship with is Adult Protective Services. I think that Adult Protective Services provides an amazing service to our public. I respect what they do so much, and I'm so grateful that they exist, but they're in a tough spot because unlike CPS, Child Protective Services, who are sort of required to work with my office and provide my office, you know, their reports and any information that they have, Adult Protective Services is bound by confidentiality oftentimes to their clients, because their clients are adults. And so we don't have a lot of overlap between the police reports and the cases that we're getting from law enforcement with the Adult Protective Services side of it. And sometimes we're really fortunate and we can get a hold of those reports, and we are always shocked to find that there are, you know, usually multiple calls for service at a particular address or with a particular victim, that whoever has been victimizing them, that it's been happening for a while. And Adult Protective Services typically knows more about the situation than we do. And so I do wish that we had more of an open sort of channel or communication with Adult Protective Services, because oftentimes when you have a caseworker who, you know, has built a relationship and a rapport with victims or a set of parents, they would be the very best witnesses to come in and say, you know, here's the dynamic in the family, and I've known this family for a couple of years, and here's what I've observed, and here are the things that, here's the history and things that have happened. And you know, I think that they have such valuable knowledge. And I do wish that there is a way that we could sort of open the channels of communication where, you know, we're not putting them in a difficult position to violate any of their privacy and confidentiality mandates. But, you know, that's the one thing that I really do wish we were able to change. So, they provide incredibly important services to our community, but they do have their privacy obligations. So that makes it really difficult. They don't, they don't necessarily have open channels of communication with our police agencies in the same way that Child Protective Services does. So, what I did want to do is make sure we have 10 minutes or so to talk about, to answer questions. I'm going to go ahead and stop screen sharing so that you have a face to interact with. But if you have questions about the process or anything, I will do my very best to answer it.
Thank you, Bethel. I'm trying to form my questions here. How does APS work with the police?
So the police are typically required to make an APS report, sort of under a mandated reporter role. And so there are automatically generated reports that the police will fill out the sheet and send it to APS so that APS knows that there's this ongoing investigation or claim happening. And sometimes the police will request the APS's file on that particular victim or household. And sometimes APS can send it along to the police and the police will then send it to me. And sometimes there are privacy issues that prevent that. And so there may be a lot going on behind the scenes that we're not privy to, and that can be difficult.
Okay, I want to ask you more about that, but first let me ask Carol Downey. She's had her hand up for a bit.
Do you have a hotline that people can call into? I would think that that would be an advantage if, you know, rather than anonymously, if they have something that they see or that they think is abuse, that they could get a hold of somebody that way.
Gosh, that is an amazing idea. You know, I don't know of a central hotline. I know that, you know, people can call the police, and I believe that there's a mechanism for reporting directly to APS under sort of that mandated reporter mechanism, but I don't think that that's very publicly advertised. I don't think I would know even who to call at APS if I wanted to report, you know, something going on one of my own family members. I think I would start with the police. And so I don't think that there is a centralized hotline that exists. That's a great suggestion.
Thank you, Carol. Anything else there? Sherry.
Yes, thank you. First of all, thank you so much for what you do. Victims, no matter how old, really need an advocate. And because you're right, the hardest thing to be is a victim. And I was wondering, I know with domestic violence, you take the onus off the victim. And if there's a crime, the police charge the crime, whether you recant or not, because you are going to be threatened. You better change your mind or story, or I'm going to do something terrible. But if the same could be done for seniors, so that the onus is taken off of them. And well, there was one other question, but I can't remember it right now. So that would be fine. Thank you.
Yes, no. So Sherry, you're exactly on the right track. So that's why we're always looking for corroboration, because in my opinion, the perfect trial to put on is a trial where I never have to call the victim to the stand. That can be really traumatic to have to come in and testify in front of a jury. It's terrifying. I've never had to testify in front of a jury myself. But if we have enough corroboration where we have neighbors who can come in and testify to what they saw, we have a doctor who can come in and testify to what happened when they got to the hospital and what statements were made there, then we don't have to put on the victim at all. We don't have to ask them to participate in that very difficult way. And that is truly the perfect, you know, trial, the perfect way to go about it. We try very hard, but corroboration is really key in that regard.
Thank you. Oh, I remember the other thing I wanted to say. When you do call the police, and I do appreciate what they do, because sometimes that's what you need, is somebody to go in there. But sometimes, is it changing a little bit to have people that come out that are more like social workers, that are more, that it's easier to talk to? Sometimes big men with guns, it's intimidating and it's hard. So if you had maybe social workers or caseworkers or people out there that know how to de-escalate the situations also, is there a move to kind of be changing the police or training the police a little bit different, so we're not bad guys?
I love that question, Sherry, because that's actually one of my goals in this position. And I did it in domestic violence too. I I used to be a teacher, so I'm really big on training, and I try to create a rapport with all of the agencies. Now I'm countywide, so I have like 30 agencies here in Orange County to work with. But I have tried to, you know, once we get in touch with the detectives and really get that rapport and get them sort of on board with what we're looking for when they're submitting cases to us, sort of moving to the next level and getting in the sergeant's ear to allow me to begin to train patrol. So some agencies are actually really good at what we call trauma-informed interviewing skills, and some agencies are still a little behind on that. So that's one of the things I too would love to see happen and I'm really trying to work towards. And I would encourage you all, because you're a stakeholder in this community, you know, if you want to contact your local departments and see if you can get in front of what we call roll call trainings. It's usually just a 15-minute stint where, you know, the next shift of patrol officers are about to go out into the street and do their job, but you've got 15 minutes to give them some sound bites about what might be helpful. Honestly, I've seen a huge change in police reports and the questions that they're asking and sort of the steps that they're taking just by getting in front of the newer patrol officers in an agency.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John.
Hi, Bethel. Do you folks manage the scam side of this process as well?
So we do. My office does. That leans towards the financial abuse. That's where Tina Patel, one of my colleagues from the fraud department, she handles most of that. There's also... I've done some work with the Elder Abuse Forensics Center here in Orange County. And if you're not familiar with that organization, they do a lot of great work and they tend to collect information and sort of they're a hub for kind of keeping their finger on the pulse of that sort of stuff. So the Elder Abuse Forensics Center, they're out of UCI. One of their clinics, but they're sort of watching that as well.
That seems to have exploded as well. It seems like we're inundated every day with some kind of scam, and they're actually on the computer, they're getting pretty good at it. I mean, they're able to pretty closely mimic. You really have to look closely at your email traffic or you can be drawn into something. I clicked on Zoom this morning. Well, at least I thought it was Zoom. Instead, it was Zoom Info. And I'm going, well, this doesn't look like Zoom. So I got out of there real quick. But it's just amazing how you can be led to do certain things that you think are legit and instead may or may not be. And then the trouble begins.
They will even, I've seen several cases a couple of years ago, more when I was doing general felonies, where scammers will call somebody on the phone and somehow spoof the voice of their own grandchild. Grandma, I got arrested in Vegas and I really need you to bail me out. Can you send me some money? And, you know, they're very believable at things like that. It really is, it's exploding. So you're right.
We had that happen to us. It was our grandson's voice and they had digitalized his voice. And it was his voice. There was no doubt. It was really disconcerting because, you know, you don't know if somebody has him somewhere with a gun to his head or what the situation was. You know, it was very scary. There, my husband, my daughter, and myself all talked to him and we knew it was his voice. There was no doubt.
Okay, go ahead again, John.
Bethel, is the Elder Abuse Forensic Center headed by Dr. Burnite? Is that who the contact point is?
Do you know Dr. Burnite's first name?
Kerry. Kerry.
Female Kerry?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Oh, I see Elizabeth nodding. Gosh, the name doesn't sound super familiar, but I know that there is a woman doctor. I let me get back to you about that. What I can do is send an email just to verify, because I'm not sure. There's a gentleman who sort of runs it, and they consult with one of the professors over there, a woman, but I can't think of her name off the top of my head, so I would want to get back to you about that.
Okay, thank I you. Did find it online. It's UC Irvine. They've got a web link, website. I have kind of an unformed question about the mentally challenged child, because you said that it's mostly the son, sometimes a daughter, who has mental issues. So does that person's mental issues somehow hamper the investigation or prosecution?
From the outset, no. They will be arrested. You know, even if you are mentally ill, you certainly don't have the right to terrorize anybody or break your parents' bones, injury, things like that. Once the case is charged, sometimes that mental illness will change the trajectory of how it goes. So I've got a couple of cases like that where the case, they've been sent out for sort of incompetency in the case, and they will most likely end up in sort of a permanent county supervised conservatorship called a Murphy conservatorship, which means that they will be in custody for the foreseeable future. It just won't necessarily be in jail with a conviction. It will be in a state mental hospital.
Okay. Do you have any ideas on how to kind of deal with the fact that so much of it comes from mentally challenged children?
Mental illness is really the big challenge I think we're facing just across the board crime-wise right now, because the courts, we're so behind. We really don't have the tools to kind of deal with real mental illness. From my role in the system, my biggest concern is keeping people safe. And so I do want to make sure that the mentally ill, you know, child or grandchild or family member is in a place where they can't continue to hurt the victim. And that can look a lot of different ways. But we do find that when the family wants to get involved, you know, I have a case where mom, bless her heart, she is an incredible woman. And of course, this case comes with a lot of the enabling and denial that we see in a lot of these cases, but finances aren't an issue for them. They've got great insurance. She would love to have him ordered to she has a hospital in mind that she would love to have her son, who's nearing 60, ordered to, and that's just not something that the criminal courts can do. The judge can, after a conviction, make a prison sentence for prison, or we can go the incompetency route and they can, you know, be found mentally incompetent and be in a state hospital. So there's definitely big gaps. I do think that, at least with the system we have right now, for the victims, helping them to get an understanding that really they're going to be better off and safer if their mentally ill child is not with them in the home. I think that's one of the big hurdles, to sort of just allowing them, giving them permission to let go and sort of let the system work and let it happen. And it's not ideal. It's not an ideal system, but they want to fight it. Obviously, if it's my kid, I'd want my will imposed for him too. So that's sort of getting that them to step back and let it happen is hard.
Okay. Do you have any statistics on how many cases come from? hang in there, Jim. Do you have any statistics on how many cases come from from mentally ill children or anything like that?
Anecdotally, I'll tell you that with my caseload and all, I've got the serious injuries, all of them, there's a level of mental illness happening when someone is terrorizing their parent or their grandchild. Okay. Varying levels of mental illness, but all of them.
Okay, thank you. Does anybody else have questions? John, your hand's up. Is that an old hand?
Blow it, removing. There you go.
Okay. any other questions for Bethel? I want to thank you again so much. This is really helpful for us. We're going to have a discussion afterwards about what information we have gathered that we would like to make recommendations for next year for the Board of Supervisors. So you have helped us tremendously in our mission. We're new at this, as I mentioned earlier. So all of your information was entirely relevant.
Oh, good. Well, thank you all so much. Thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for letting me come and speak about my job. And I'm here and I'm available if questions come up, and I can't promise I'll have all the answers, but you know, it's a team sport. So we all work together. We get a lot further. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. We have on the chair items. The first one is the presentation schedule. I guess everybody has heard that Erica will be leaving, and congratulations to Erica. In September, we have the public libraries, and in October, Erica was going to give us an Office on Aging update. I would imagine, however, that there will be somebody stepping in. So I don't know, Lillian, is there?
Evelyn, I had emailed you last week. Erica did request to remove the presentation off the schedule because while there is a recruitment to have, I don't know that we'll have someone in time and well, whether or not they'll be ready to give a presentation that soon. Okay. So
there isn't a deputy?
Not an assistant.
No. Okay, good. All right, well, we are looking then for a speaker for October. Anybody have ideas? Maybe we can get somebody from this Center of Excellence on Elder Abuse and Neglect. Anybody want to try to contact somebody there for a speaking engagement? And as you will know by now, I can maintain silence for a long time while you think about it.
Okay, I was muted. If I have a phone number, I could try.
Yeah, sure.
So just email me the name and phone number and such, and then I
will email you the link to their website.
Okay, but okay. Who am I going to be calling?
You're going to call the main office and ask if they have a speakers bureau. I'm seeing here that they have an elder care locator hotline. I have no idea what that is. I haven't really researched there. I just looked this up. If they don't have a speakers bureau, somebody who can talk to the purpose and the research that has been achieved. Okay, I'll send you the link. Thank you, Elizabeth. Uh-huh. Let me know if you have any problems with that.
Okay.
Okay, so that'll then be for October. November, we have our own John Poynter. John, I hope you're going to be prepared. I know you never have anything to talk about. Wait a second, I just lost my Zoom. Where is it? There we go. Okay. All right. Thank you. And then for new business, I did want to have a discussion on our direction regarding elder abuse. We've had a little bit of information on it now from, I think, two or three speakers. So what What are your thoughts, please? Carol.
Yeah. When I asked her about a hotline this morning, maybe that's something that we can look into. Finding a way to establish, sometimes when people see elder abuse and that kind of thing, they're hesitant to call the police because of the interaction. I mean, they want more of a social worker type situation. And so I don't know how you would establish a hotline with an office like she has so that people could get a hold of somebody that they could talk to that would be able to help them. You know, if I see a neighbor abused, or as a teacher, I was a mandatory reporter, of course, and I had a hotline to call for child abuse. And it would seem like you could have a hotline to call for elder abuse too.
Yeah.
Can't you just call APS? You just go straight to APS.
You can.
That is a possibility, but in that case, then it needs to be probably advertised as such. Give a little bit more on this.
Yeah.
What she mentioned about Good Samaritans that report anonymously, how that really doesn't help anything.
No, you would have to give your information. APS, what does APS do when you report, Elizabeth?
Adult Protective Services.
Yeah, but what do they do when you report it then?
They go to the house and
Do they? Okay.
Yeah,
I've been told, and really look into the matter.
So there's probably not a police department involved in that until it's investigated further.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, there are social workers basically who come out and do the initial work and investigation. They do get the police involved and they do get the district attorney involved, according to the presentations we've had, but there seems to be some kind of privacy confidentiality issue that limits the flow of information or constrains it.
And they have the line, they have the hotline too. I know they do.
Yes.
I know they do. But okay, that answers my question. Thank you.
Okay.
Can I follow up on Carol's question? It would be great if 911, when you call 911 emergency, it doesn't matter what if you need fire, they'll send the fire department. If you need police, they'll send the police department. There ought to be a way that they could send workers like protective service workers or social workers. The call would automatically go to an adult protective services type social workers and caseworkers. So that the 911 number would still be for the emergency, but it could just be directed to wherever, because everyone knows that number. A hotline, even though that's a great idea, someone like me as a neighbor would have to look for it and find it.
That's true.
And if you could just call 911 and direct your call to whatever office your emergency pertains to, that would really help.
That's a good idea, Sharon. That's a good idea.
I don't know how to do that, though.
Any other thoughts?
Sherry, I'm not sure they're going to let you tie up 911 with, that's an extremely important call, but I would sure like the Office of Aging to speak to us in terms of, so the idea of 911, you've got an ADRC, Aging and Disability Resources Center. You've got a 211 line that you man. Is there something that could field these calls and direct them to someone that will take the information like a police report and follow up on it. That would be nice to hear more about, because I think you're right. I think Carol's right too, in terms of getting the information into the system as quickly as possible for someone to respond to is the goal we're after. So what system is available to do that? And how do we market that, or how do we promote that?
Yeah, John, this is Lillian. That's a good point. For Office on Aging and also ADRC, along with 211, they're all information and resources call center, and they only work, you know, the limited core business hours. So while during business hours, it may be effective, and we all are also mandated reporting. We have the reporting requirements. However, you know, if there's like after hours and stuff like that, people would need to leave a message. And then, yes, when we do take those and we do get some of those calls sometimes, then we would report, just like what Elizabeth mentioned, we would report to APS, or sometimes if they do are on linked to social services or whatnot, we do reach out to their social worker or what, but we always, if we do take any of those calls, we do always report them to APS.
Hey, Lillian, isn't there a new federal hotline too for mental health, 988?
Yes.
So we've got these various hotline numbers to call. It would be nice if somebody came up with an idea to put a magnet on the refrigerator door that basically said, so this is what, this is who you call for what, you know. It doesn't have to be elaborate, but I'm getting a little confused in terms of who to call. And I'm sure a lot of people simply resort to 911 and get told, that's not an emergency, John. You know, this is only designed for emergencies or whatever. So it'd be nice if somebody thought that was a cool idea and we were able to develop something like that in Orange County.
Yeah, I think so too. Maybe it wouldn't be just for elder, but it could also be encompassing like for like minors, you know what I mean? Like any type of abuse. To go for that, you know, so that way it's universal for everyone. But I think somebody needs to recommend that somewhere up in the Capitol or wherever it may be. So,
well, maybe that'll come from this committee through the executive board up through. So something to consider.
Yes.
I think that's really needed. I think we all agree that is really needed. I have
there you go, Evelyn. We got something coming out of today's meeting.
Yeah,
because I'm sorry, Elizabeth, just 1 minute. Because it is, there isn't a national hotline. I mean, there isn't any kind of you know, you have to know who to call. Mm-hmm. We know that there is an agency called Adult Protective Services. I'd never heard of it before. So having a simple hotline number, I think, does really sound great. Elizabeth, I'm sorry I interrupted. Go ahead.
On here, it says new business discussion on committee's direction regarding elder abuse. Mm-hmm. Our ad hoc committee was told that we are not appreciated. That Lillian can really speak to this. The Office on Aging is taking care of it. You guys just stay out of it. You're only in the way. You're not appreciated, because the whole point of our ad hoc committee was we were going to give suggestions to the Board of Supervisors. Well, apparently it's not wanted. Is this correct, Lillian?
This is the first time that I've heard of this, Elizabeth. I'm not part of that ad hoc committee, so I'm not aware of that. As far as me being an employee of Office on Aging, I'm not aware of that. So perhaps I can research and find out, and I'll come back next month and let you guys know.
That would be great, because I got the impression that stay out of it. Office on Aging is taking care of it. They're doing a good job. And you guys are not needed.
So the Council on Aging has a program which takes care of abuses when they're reported in facilities, but maybe they should, and they have people that they can go to. Maybe they could have some ideas of systems that can be used in non-facilities.
They do, Jim.
Yeah.
And I know that there's like a multidisciplinary team called FAST, and I know that Evelyn is also enrolled in it effective last month. So there is such thing that, you know, it's encompassing basically social workers, legal, the law enforcement, a lot of different organizations and different entities in there. And again, you know, they share different cases just to brainstorm and assist with elder abuse. And also, like you mentioned, the ombudsman program as well. But relating to what Elizabeth is talking about, I'm not aware of. So I would need to take a look, you know, I'll go back and do some research. I don't know who said that to Elizabeth, but I'll find out and I'll come back.
You know, I think what a person who wants to report abuse of some kind normally would call 911, and they wouldn't know, like with child abuse, elder abuse. So I would think that it would be helpful to have, like John talked about, something that you know that you can call, because 911 would say, no, that's not an emergency. So then you hang up the phone and who do you call? You know, it's not, it's the average person who is trying to report something needs to have that, or it would be good to have that kind of information. You know,
A suggestion, the Council on Aging does have a program and they could probably provide a speaker. And we now have an open position for a speaker for October.
Yes,
I could certainly get in touch with them and I'm sure that they would provide a speaker and answer some of those questions on how they handle these abuse calls.
So the Council on Aging is different from Adult Protective Services?
Oh, yes. So totally different.
And so they receive different calls? Why do they get different calls?
Because they are involved with anyone who's in a long-term care facility.
Oh, okay.
And that is their primary goal, is to protect the residents in all of these facilities for any abuse or other problems that come up. And they have methods and they have connections with other organizations that can handle the abuse. We report the problem and then they take care of going through the proper channels to get people to resolve the problems. And that's why I think if we got a speaker, and I know we could get a speaker to come and give us some of this information, that would be good at a SCAC meeting.
Oh, well, thank you, Jim. Would you be able to do that for October 17th?
I certainly will.
Thank you very much. Elizabeth, you're off the hook.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that Elizabeth was going to be doing it something.
No. I had asked Elizabeth to follow up with this Elder Abuse Forensic Center, which I will follow up with them myself for a later time. But I think the Council on Aging sounds a little bit more relevant right now.
Okay, so I'll move in and make the contact and get in touch with you.
Okay.
So would this be for a SCAC meeting or for a LEDGE meeting?
This is for our LEDGE meeting, which is not LEDGE, it's engagement.
I know, I never rolled names.
No.
So Evelyn,
I have such a hard time getting senior citizen engagement committee out.
Right. So Evelyn, what Jim is dealing with or proposing deals with people who are, poor choice of terms, I'll use it anyway, institutionalized, right? Mm-hmm. They're in assisted living nursing homes. That kind of thing.
The
other side of the coin is the people that are being abused at home by relatives or other individuals they have a contact with and are not institutionalized at this point in time. So what we'll be hearing, I think, is right. So here's a reporting system they have for people who are institutionalized that may or may not apply to what is going on in the community outside of nursing homes and that kind of thing. Right, Jim?
They go beyond that. The people who they report to go beyond that. I mean, even if they have to go to the police department on certain issues, they know how to do those things.
Yes. I'm just defining the climate it's being performed in.
We did have a speaker. Well, Jim, you got us a speaker in March on the Ombudsman program. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're talking about?
I had a speaker on. Did I have?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Anderson or Woolery? Are you talking about somebody other than the Ombudsman program?
No, I'm not.
No?
Maybe we don't want that person if you don't think they could help.
Well, it's not that they can't help. It's a different side of the coin, as John said. There are the people who are institutionalized, and then there are people who are free range.
Right.
And they pretty much do have a good handle on, I mean, because there would be a system of reporting, obviously, in which is the Ombudsman program, which is effective, but it's for seniors who are just out there uninformed, living in their own home with this troublesome son. An abusive son. That was what Bethel was talking to us about today. So, okay, Elizabeth, you're back on for October 17th.
Okay. All right.
I want to mention another side of the coin. When I worked in board, we were talking about mental health, and these kids that are institutionalized in boarding cares go back and forth to their parents when they're out, you know, when they go back. Mental hospitals have crisis teams. That's who the board and cares call, that they come out and they evaluate the person that's in a psychotic crisis. And they can determine whether they need to be taken back to the hospital. They have ambulances with restraints and people that know how to restrain people that are in crisis that way. And their families can call these crisis teams from home too, when there's, you know, a mental health issue. So there are a lot of people to call, but if you don't have a mental hospital on speed dial, you know, you might not know that. And so that's why I was thinking that there's so many different issues that if one call center could direct your call toward any of those things, whether you need a crisis team sent out there to see if it's a mental health issue, lots of people could respond, but they're just scattered.
Sherry, explain a little bit more, please. Are you saying that there are general, like, mental health facilities with the crisis teams that would respond to any mental incident?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, mental hospitals where you take these people just in case they need to be held on a 5150, you know, for their own safety or others. Let's say your kid is acting out and you don't know what to do. You can call a crisis team, or we would call a crisis team at the board and care if they were getting really violent. We were trained to deal with violent people, but sometimes you need to do something with them. They needed to be hospitalized. And so we call a crisis team and they evaluate, and some patients can walk their way right around a crisis team, but it's another tool in the toolbox to help get people the help they need.
I really like that idea, but I'd want to hear more about the crisis teams and, you know, what numbers and where they are and stuff.
I don't know the price of the mental hospitals that were in the valley, like Pine Grove was a mental hospital and they had crisis teams. And But I'm afraid that they've probably gotten less and less and less money over the years. So I'm not really sure what the current condition is, but that's who we called when we needed someone for mental patients.
Okay. Sherry, are you saying that there needs to be an umbrella type of structure where you have an umbrella where all these agencies are all under one umbrella where you can, if you need abuse situations, if you need mental health situations, that you would be able to make one call and they could direct it?
Ideally, that would be easiest, you know, whatever hotline, you know, we come up with, but that would be just somewhere for them to direct calls that, you know, if you have a psychotic man in a crisis, you know, you can call and have them evaluated and put on a 5150, because sometimes when you call the police kill them, you know,
a lot of unfortunately,
Doesn't the Office on Aging have a 511 number for any type of emergency that comes up and they redirect people to the proper place? I think the Office on Aging has that program.
Well, I really like approaching elder abuse by dealing with the mental challenges of children. You know, giving parents the tools. So, okay, I'm a parent, I'm being abused, I don't want to report it. You know, 75% of them are going to recant their statements. But if they are given the information for how to refer their child, how to get their child help, that might actually be another avenue for addressing elder abuse.
Yeah, they don't report it because they don't want their child to go to jail.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's just normal.
But if they're getting treatment.
Right. It would be a whole different story.
They're getting treatment and they're stopping, and they've stopped abusing me. You know, they're. Okay. Well, thank you. I think that was pretty helpful. So we'll talk about it a little bit more in January in terms of forming some recommendations to SCAC in our annual report. Okay, Desiree, if you're awake, do we have to vote on an extra meeting between now and
for the virtual meeting
in October?
We will need a special meeting.
We will need a special meeting. And did you make a recommendation for what date we?
No, I was actually just working on that. It looks like the next SCAC general meeting is on September 9th, and that would still keep us within the time frame. Okay. If you want to just have that special meeting prior to the SCAC meeting on that month.
Okay, so that would be like, that's Talk Like a Pirate Day. I'm sorry, that's in my calendar, because you can get a free Krispy Kreme donut if you talk like a pirate. Just FYI. Okay, so let's look at that. All right, so action item AB 361. The recommendation is to continue virtual meetings due to the proclaimed state of emergency arising from COVID-19. Meeting in person presents imminent risk to the health and safety of attendees, and the emergency continues to directly impact the ability of the members to meet safely in person. Do I have a motion?
Yes.
I'll second him.
Okay, and Sherry is seconding. Desiree, would you please do a roll call?
Of course. Tony Alabado?
Yes.
Elizabeth Busick? Oh, I think we lost Elizabeth.
She dropped off. Yeah.
Carol Downey?
Aye.
Scott Fye? Carolyn Inman? Paolo Morales? Elaine Genoway? Sherry Horn?
Aye.
Jim Levy?
Aye.
John Pointer?
Aye.
Tony Rodella?
Aye.
Dave Tetzloff?
Aye.
And Evelyn Velez.
Yes.
That is majority chair.
Okay, great. Thank you. And that will be then set up for September 9th.
Correct.
Okay. Subcommittee report. Dave, you had something kind of brought up the other day by Erica, I thought. I saw you scribbling notes furiously.
Well, Erica announced that the Orange County is applying for a $3.4 million tech grant that would expand the original program of 2,200 iPads that were distributed, would include funding for education at Orange County senior centers and so forth. So they're in the process of writing the grant, and then hopefully by sometime in October, they should have final word on that. I'm not sure what the distribution period would be for that grant. I will check with Erica and report back next month on more details of the grant. So that is good news. I guess it's all based on the very successful program that was initiated by our advisory committee to the board and so forth. So it's been a very successful program, and hopefully we'll be able to continue to expand on that. So that was the good news. Of course, the sad news was the leaving of Erica, and but I'll work with Erica. And there was a report that was presented, I believe, to the AAA agencies, and I'll see if we can get a report on that for our committee.
Okay. Could you also get more information on what is all being proposed for the $3.4 million tech grant?
That's what I will, okay. Said I will do. Yes.
Great. Thank you. I'd love to see what that's about. Anything else that you have or your committee members? Okay, I'm going to skip over the Elder Abuse Subcommittee since we already talked rather extensively about that. And John Pointer, would you please give us a legislative tracking update?
Thank you, Evelyn. The following bills made it through appropriations on Wednesday, I believe it was. Tuesday and Wednesday, I think it was. AB 2077. 2077 is the personal needs allowance increase from $35 to $80.
You said it made it through?
It made it through. It was in suspense.
Whoa!
I didn't think it was going to get out of there, and it made it through.
From 35 to?
80.
To 80. My goodness, that's even more than you asked for, isn't it?
Correct.
Wow, that's phenomenal. Yeah, good work, CSL.
So remember, I try not to get too excited until the governor signs these things because he's the wild card. But anyway, I'm just going to continue. AB 2511, backup electrical supply made it through. AB 2069, home health aid training program scholarship made it through. SB 842, that's the pilot program in Northern California for the reuse of medical goods, has made it through. 2145 is on the way to the governor's office. That's oral health and skilled nursing facilities.
Excellent.
And 2338, default hierarchy surrogate consent laws, is on the Senate floor for a third reading.
What was that one again?
Say what?
What was that last one?
AB 2338, default hierarchy surrogate consent laws. We're one of think, 5 states that don't have that provision. So one of our members has pushed a proposal through that has become a bill in order to make us line up more with the other 45 states in the country. Again, the rubber meets the road at the governor's desk. So by September 30th, he either signs it, it gets approved by default, and it just, you know, it sits on his desk. And if it sits on his desk, it will ultimately be approved, or he says no. So we'll anxiously await to see what transpires in the next 45 days. But that's 8, that's 6 out of 8 bills that are still going forward. That's pretty awesome.
I am so impressed that you got 2077 through the House.
Yeah. Don't ask for an explanation, Evelyn. It's just, I think sometimes you're at the right place or it's the right time. And, you know, if you sit on surpluses long enough, sooner or later, I guess there's enough money to provide a cost of living increase.
Congratulations, John. Congratulations.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. That's isn't that amazing?
It is.
Now that leads me to also remind everybody that there are some bills that there are some proposals that will be heard in October that involve some pretty significant issues. Grandparent custody of grandchildren, attempting to streamline that. There are any number of, and it's really a socioeconomic issue. If you have the money to afford the attorney fees, then you're going to try and proceed to legally adopt your grandchildren when the alternative is foster care. If you don't have the money, then you just bring them into the household and assume the costs. So what does that mean? Mm. So that means that they're not covered under your medical plan. That means there's no legal custody for them. You're being asked to make perhaps medical decisions for them, and you're not legally the guardian, or they have not been adopted by you. So,
and that means that the parents could come back anytime and take kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lots of, and yet it's not fully documented, but I think we're estimating that between 20 and 25% of kids in school, now this is staggering, are living with their grandparents.
John, I can attest to that. That does not surprise me at all.
So that's, again, that's pretty scary. But, you know, we're talking about blood relations, so you'll do anything you can to protect the children. So that's where we're at. We think that's a really big issue out there. Another is wildfires and fire insurance. The Register had an article in the Sunday paper talking about fires and how insurance has gone up. So we think there are 3 issues with home insurance involving, and this is only seniors. Our audience, our constituency is seniors. So the insurance company takes a look at the situation and has a couple of different alternatives. They'll send you a cancellation notice and basically tell you we're no longer insuring in this area. Or they'll simply price you out of the insurance market. They'll double or triple the insurance. And for those of seniors on a fixed income, which is a great deal, they can't renew. If you don't renew, you better hope you own the home, because then your mortgage is in trouble. So anyway, the third issue that we're throwing in the proposal is offering a tax credit for seniors that they call it hardening your property. By that it means that, you know, you're basically making improvements that reduce the odds of a fire engulfing your home. So it's just like what has been offered for homeowners that install solar. So you get a tax credit for installing solar on your home, providing a tax credit for those people that take actions to either, you know, have brush removed, provide additional landscaping that's fire retardant, or making improvements to the home in order to protect it. So we'll see where that goes. Those are just two. A couple of others involve ageism. Ageism is going to be a topic at the Senior Rally Day next year. And also a proposal involving Volunteer Day, Senior Volunteer Day in May, around the May 2nd. Gee, I think that's right. May 2nd Senior Rally Day for 2023. So let me just quickly. Yes, May 2nd. So those are a couple of topics that we're looking at in 2023. Financial elder abuse is something that, again, we're looking at, but boy, that's difficult to get your hands around. We all know the issue, but you can't shut your phone off. We'd like to sometimes. Like it or not, the computer has become our communication tool. So, I can't tell you how many people have been scammed through Facebook now. So, and the young people have basically moved away from Facebook, and it's becoming more and more of an adult tool. A lot of seniors are on Facebook and falling prey to scams. So Evelyn, that's just a quick update on where we're at and where we think we're looking at going in 2023.
Thank you. And when do you kind of cement your plans for where you're going in 2023? I mean, there's still time to add or suggest something for discussion?
No, you can get on board. However, remember our legislative proposals are submitted a year ahead of mm-hmm. the legislative cycle. So we're looking at 2024.
Okay.
So our ledge proposals that will begin in January of 2023 and will be finalized and submitted to CSL headquarters in June of 2023. But as we all know, every day, time moves quickly. So it may seem like a long ways away, but before you know it, it's right here. So it's not really that far away.
Okay.
And lastly, Evelyn, we're all watching to see what the elections in November in California are going to generate in terms of our elected officials. Approximately 25% of our elected officials have either announced they're resigning. I'm not sure what resigning and not running again, how that's different, but not running again, or have significant competition and will not be, are running behind. So that's a quarter of the legislators in Sacramento. So we'll have new people to get acquainted with what CSL is and what we do and how important we are to older Californians. That's all I've got, Evelyn.
Okay, thank you. And Dave, you have your hand up. Did you have a question for John?
I just had an additional comment for John. I know you were just yards away from the fire this year and came very close to your house. We had a fire in the foothills just a couple years ago. And even though the fire never got close to us, we were in the, the secondary evacuation area, voluntary evacuation area. And over the last two or three years, our association fire insurance premiums have gone up 500%.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, and I know yours is probably going to go up too, or not be available. And this is for the association. That didn't even include the outside of the house. This,
right.
Or it just covers the outside of the house.
Yes.
And just calculating that, that was just, it dropped maybe a few points, maybe two or three years ago. But since that fire in the foothills, it's gone up 500%. And for seniors, that is a substantial increase in cost.
Yeah. That's an excellent point, Dave. And the planned community at the bottom at Crown Valley, the HOA is dealing with that now. They've been told they're in a high risk. They said, well, the fire was half a mile up the road and to the right. You're in a high risk area. It's non-negotiable. Your insurance just gone up 300%. If you want to argue over it, we'll cancel you. Okay, so take it or leave it's basically the attitude at this point. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I don't want to be overly dramatic or, but sort of reminds me of what many of us faced with property taxes years ago before Prop 13 was introduced. And I understand the insurance as a profit motive. I mean, they're there to make money. So how do we balance this without basically creating a crisis, a financial crisis? And I don't know that the state can be the insurer as well. So I don't know if we got an answer. I don't think what we have proposed is necessarily the answer, but I think we've got to raise the issue before it turns into a crisis and see how we work together to try and find the solution. But it's scary right now. And it's, you know, it's just a matter of time as the policies become renewed before everybody gets sucked up in this. So you're absolutely right. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you, John. That was exciting. Jim, you have your hand up?
On you, there.
Okay.
Now I have one additional question. I don't know, I was not able to get on the program earlier today because I had some computer problems. But was there any discussion on this meeting that's coming up on September 20th in Sacramento called the California for All Ages and Abilities Day of Action? Was there any discussion on that?
At this meeting, Jim?
Yes.
No, I hadn't raised it. I'll be happy to talk to it if you like.
Well, I think it might be worthwhile sharing with everyone.
So on September 20th, the California Department of Aging is pulling together a meeting in Sacramento at the convention center adjacent to the Sheraton, not the one on the other side of town by the Capitol lawn. And it's a meeting that begins at 8:30 and closes at 4:30. There was a registration. That registration is now only accepting, is closed, and they're taking a waiting list. So they're full. So and it's basically designed to review the, I haven't seen an agenda yet, but I understand it's basically designed to review where they've been and where they want to go, and basically rally stakeholders in the community involving senior issues around what the plan is for 2023. So I think we have 8 people in CSL that have registered to go.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions for John or comments? That was a great report, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evelyn.
I'm just still so impressed with how effective CSL has been. Okay, moving on to new membership. Our new member has not come, so I don't know that he will be. 11, announcements and roundtable discussions. Is there anything else that you want to discuss? And Carol?
I have a question. I have a question for Desiree. You know, I still have not taken that. It's not conflict of interest, but it's the other one. I still have not, and I haven't been able to find it on my computer. Desiree, do we have to have that completed? What's the status on that?
Are you referring to the ethics training?
Yeah. Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up.
It does need to be done, yes.
Could you
I can't
send
find
out a
it
link
on...
again?
Do you need the link again?
Yeah, I do. I need it. I can't find it on my computer.
Me too.
Okay. Oh,
I think to all of us. Well, except for John.
Okay, so let me take a note of who needs it. I don't want to bother everybody else with an email. So Evelyn, Jim, Tony, Carol, and Dave.
This is due by the end of December, right?
Correct.
Thank you, Carol, for bringing that up.
I had forgotten all about it. And then I thought, oh, that ethics.
Where is it?
Yeah.
And who sent it?
Yeah. It went, it's out there somewhere.
Yeah.
In computer land, and I don't know where it is.
Hey, Desiree.
Yes.
When I tried to get in, you know, using the email that was sent to us, and it was a little difficult to figure out which one you're clicking on in order to get in. So if you're going to send an email back out, could you isolate the email, the HTTP address a little bit more, because, you know, there's a state one, there's a local one. There was some other information. So
for the training?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you also need the email also?
No, I'm in it. I'm on lesson 5.
Okay.
Plodding along. Remember, folks, if it doesn't take you 2 hours, they're going to kick you out, and you have to start from square one again. There is no, well, I'll go do another 30 minutes. You start all the way over again. You go back to square one. So,
but you can pause in between, right?
You can quit and save and quit and go back. Yes. Uh-huh.
Right.
Yes.
Which one are we supposed to take? The state?
No, that's for us, Dave, CSL. So there's a separate requirement. So this one doesn't qualify. Why? I have no clue. Okay. It's basically the same stuff. So you have to take this thing twice if you're a CSL member.
Okay.
Well, which one are we supposed to take?
Once for CSL, once for a state employee. What's that?
Okay, which one are we supposed to take for SCAC?
Local.
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 Okay. Public matters, I don't see anybody. Any members of the public, is that correct, Desiree?
Correct. We do not have any members of the public, and we did not receive any requests to speak in advance.
Okay, great. Thank you. Well, then it is time for our adjournment. And our next meeting is September 19th at 9:30. I really want to thank you all for some great discussion today and information. I hope you're doing well and look forward to seeing you next month. Bye-bye.
All right.